Today, Adam and I chat episode 5, our top property buying tips.
G'day viewers, I'm Adam Stokes, back with Martin North. Martin, thanks for joining me again tonight.
Hi Adam, how are you going?
Excellent, Martin. How's the fires going at your end? Smoke
well,
settled
I'm
down?
Pleased to say that the smoke dissipated about a day and a half ago. We had a week of horrible smoky weather and it's cooler and they're talking about rain tomorrow. So it'll be exciting. I've forgotten what rain looks like.
Yeah, we had one small bout of rain here. It was about 10 minutes very late at night. It just made everything really muddy, but it was good to have it nonetheless.
Well, I'm hoping we'll get more than just the old shower because things are so dry here. But anyway, we'll see what happens. But I'm afraid the bushfires are still raging, so it's going to be a long, slow burn, as they say.
Yeah, we mustn't forget that the fight is still on. These people are still out there on the front lines, so we wish them all the best. And
absolutely.
Most certainly to our viewers, if they'd like to donate, I've got a link on my channel below. I do it through cryptocurrency, so it's an open source ledger, so it's all completely open and transparent and 100% going to those who need it. Martin, I wanted to speak to you tonight about the tactical level of buying a house. So on your channel and many other channels, they speak about the macro snapshot of the housing market. What I hope to do tonight is really give the people insight into buying perhaps their first house, if they should buy that house, and possibly expanding their property portfolio. So in the first instance, we all need somewhere to live. And there has been some debate about renting versus buying. Now, if anything, in my opinion, the psychological value of owning your own property, not dealing with rent inspections, being kicked out of your property, and just having, I guess, the little Australian dream of the white picket fence, whatever that may look like, is very empowering and a great deal of satisfaction and security. But in your mind, if no one has got a home yet and they're renting, is now the time to buy? And if it is or isn't, how would they go about buying this property?
Okay, well, to help sort of peel out that question and think about it, you need to separate two separate things, right? The first domain is about shelter, security, and control, right? And the second is the question about what the investment, if you think of it as an investment, might be doing, right? Now, the trouble is those two schools of opinion, if you like, get all scrambled in people's minds, right? But they need to be pulled out, because if you come at it simply at, I want somewhere to live, I want to, you know, a cave to basically call my own and own it, and, you know, almost irrespective of what the commercial or investment perspectives may be, then owning your own place can often make sense. But you've got to understand that what we had over the last 20 to 25 years with rabid growth is not necessarily what we're going to have ahead. So if people buy, they should be buying because it's somewhere to live, security, etc., etc. Because if you start doing the math in terms of what it costs to purchase a property, what it costs to own a property, what it costs to maintain a property, and you compare that with what you pay in terms of rent, if you were to rent somewhere, and there's a lot of rental property around, particularly, for example, in Sydney, where, in fact, there's more availability than we've probably had for the last 20 years, and rentals are lower. So if you do it on a narrow sort of commercial basis without capital gain, then you almost always do better to rent. But you trade off security. And for many people, control and security is quite important. Now, of course, if you are renting, there are rules around the rental sector. Some landlords obey those rules, some less so. So sometimes you get kicked out at very short notice, particularly if they suddenly decide they want to put the property on the market, those sorts of things. So it is, you know, what I'm trying to say to you, Adam, is it's not a simple yes, no decision. There's lots of questions and things to pull out before you can get to a point of saying, yeah, is it a good time to buy or not a good time to buy? What you shouldn't be doing is backing that decision based on the prospective investment that you might get or might not get from your capital if you invested in property? Because to my mind, that is the most unsettling and unsatisfactory way of making a decision.
Yeah, I got a lot of value out of something that you said to me offline a while ago. You said you shouldn't be investing to chase a tax benefit. And I really like that. I think the paradigm of chasing an investment portfolio to get a tax benefit is in fact very dangerous and has many, many flaws. Because in many cases, that tax benefit is washed away with many of the expenses that are involved in owning property. So going back to the Aussie battler. So you've got an Aussie battler on the front line. He's been watching your channel for some time and he really wants to get into the property market. Now, in many of the real estate books I've read, there was one statement that has always stuck with me when they say, when is the best time to buy a property? And they say, right now. And I know it's quite a broad sweeping statement. And I think, of course, that doesn't apply into the investment space. But certainly when I look at, you know, you just want to live somewhere. Ultimately, when you go to Maslow's hierarchy of needs, one of those things is you need shelter. So everyone needs somewhere to live. In my younger years, I got a lot of leverage off being in a group house where I paid for a very small portion of that house through renting essentially a room and then using the savings that I would have otherwise put in renting an entire house or buying into an entire house into building a good deposit. And when I built that really big deposit, combined with the first homeowner's grant, it got me into a property and immediately because I had bought off the plan and I was just, I guess, sheer luck. I had got in at the right time of the market. And before I even moved into that house, I had really good six-figure equity in that property before I even moved into that. But that was years ago and that was just my situation. So we've got the Aussie battler who's trying to get into a house now. Rent versus buying. What would a basic checklist that these people could go through to really compare rent versus buying?
Okay, so what you should do before you actually go rent versus buy, you need to understand what your current financial footprint is like, right? And in fact, about half of households that I survey have no idea. So the first thing to do is to methodically go through and understand what money is coming in, right? And what money is going out. And you have to get quite granular to be able to do that because there will be things that potentially you might choose not to spend money on. You know, for example, if you've got lots of subscriptions to lots of, you know, streaming services or whatever, you might decide that you prefer to trade that off to help buy the house, right? So you need to understand your current financial footprint. Then you also need to understand whether that income is secure and certain and regular, or whether it's not. Because if you are going to go down the let's buy a property route, you almost certainly need a mortgage. And to get a mortgage these days, you have to be able to have a proven track record of regular income coming in. Huge spikes, because huge spikes really are discounted now from the lenders. And therefore, it's pretty important to understand first base, right? Because basically, if you're in the situation where your income is irregular and uncertain, it's going to be very hard to be able to find a mortgage, in which case maybe rental is more secure. If, on the other hand, you can calculate that there is actually a flow of funds, which, you know, you might initially use to save for the deposit, but later you could actually use to service the mortgage, then you perhaps are in a better position to be able to explore whether buying a property makes sense. And of course, there is, if you're a first-time buyer, there is this government scheme where you can basically get a government guarantee between 80 and 95% of the value of the property. So effectively, you still borrow the 95%, but essentially the risks are assessed at 80%. So the bank is protected, not you, the bank is protected. And that's really important, right? Because quite often the alternative is lender's mortgage insurance. And that's another expense that people have to get their head around. Because if you're borrowing more than 80% by way of the mortgage, then you almost certainly will need lender's mortgage insurance. And that costs 20, 30 grand up front. Now, sometimes you can load it into the total costs of the deal and spread the costs over the mortgage and those sorts of things. But nevertheless, there is another cost to worry about there. So you start then having to sort of work around these numbers. Then what you think about is the interest rate today is X. But what happens if the interest rate is X plus 2%, right? Because we can't guarantee that mortgage rates are always going to be rock bottom where they are at the moment. They probably will be for a period, but the chances are they're ultimately going to go up. And, you know, that might be 6 months, it might be 5 years, it might be 10 years, but at some point they're going to go up. And the question is, if they did go up, would you still be able to make those mortgage repayments? Because if the answer is no, then you know that the mortgage is too big and you have to actually shrink your aspiration to a size of mortgage that is manageable. The reason I say that is because I survey households all the time around what I call mortgage stress, and that is that when the money in is not as great as the money going out. And whilst you can support that temporarily, like raiding deposits, if you will put more on credit cards or what, hunkering down, if in fact you have a cash flow issue, ultimately that's going to lead to grief down the track. It might be 18 months, 2 years, 3 years down the track. And believe me, once people are in that sort of debt cycle, it's very, very hard to get out of it. The psychological pressures are huge. The financial pressures are huge. And in some cases, I've even seen relationships fall apart, created simply by overcommitting around a property, overcommitting to a mortgage, and then not being able to pay the bills. So, you know, what I'm trying to say is these are big life-changing decisions that people get into, and yet so often they're just lured into it on the aspiration of every Australian wants to own their own piece of Australia, et cetera, et cetera. There are consequences.
I, some time ago, released a video on building a property portfolio, and I wasn't really the keen to push it out, but many of the people were asking to see it, see how I did it. And I actually say in the beginning of the video, I don't actually recommend this. And many of my subscribers were saying, you know, you've got lots of property, why don't you recommend it? And really the reason why I recommend it is for all the reasons that we've outlined in our previous discussions, is that once you put in inflation and you put in all the expenses and you put in capital gains and you put in opportunity cost and you put everything around it, it's actually not as good as it seems. It really isn't as good as it seems. And if I didn't have so much equity in my property portfolio, I'd be quite nervous, because the most important point I think you raised then is, if I can make the payments today, if that interest rate goes up a few points or many points over the next few years, how is that going to affect those payments? And ultimately the bank always gets paid. Now with lenders' mortgage insurance, of course, that's not protecting you. That's correct. Protecting the bank.
Yep.
And that is a thing that I think some people miss. They go, oh, I'll get this insurance. And insurance is normally, hey, that's covering me. No, you're paying all this extra money for covering the bank. But what I did in one of my properties, I calculated, luckily I've never actually needed a lender's mortgage insurance, but I don't always, not that I'm giving any financial advice here, and neither of us are doing that because we don't do that on this channel, but when I've looked at the calculations of lender's mortgage insurance, I've actually found that there has been, in some instances, when people are buying a very small property and they're just falling short of that deposit and they just need a few grand to push them over to get them to the 20%. When you actually calculate it and you break it down, you say, well, if you don't do this, you're still going to continue paying, for example, $400 a week rent. But if you do this, you're actually going to, your payments could actually go down to, depending what loan you get, over what period, over what interest rate, for what amount, it could actually lower your payments lower to than what you're actually paying in rent. So many people have spoken about rent being dead money, which in many instances it is. But of course, I remember in one of my properties, something broke, a hot water system broke, as eventually will happen. And that was, I don't live there, it was a rental property, but I had to pay for it. So all this money I had earned over the last few months immediately went into this hot water system. Now, of course, for the tenant, they didn't have to worry about that. All they needed to worry about was paying their weekly rent, and they got a new hot water system whenever required. But when it goes to buying a house versus a unit or an apartment, I've actually found that I now stay away from units and apartments entirely. But I seek your guidance on this. I see that the two worlds in this. First of all, if I buy a big house, I've got a big bit of land that I have to maintain one way or another. I've got four walls and a roof. On any one of those four walls, something could go wrong on the inside or outside. And if I just look at getting an apartment, on the surface it looks like it's cheaper initially. It could be a brand new structure. If it's off the plan, you may think that you're going to get some gain, and sometimes it happens if you get in early at the right time and it goes up before you even move there. But the big thing, Martin, that I don't like about apartments is the strata management fees and the body corporate fees. In my opinion, I think they are criminal in the sense that I'm not calling these people criminal. I'm calling the whole concept criminal because there seems to be no limit on what they, A, what they set it at, and B, what they spend it on. So for those getting into the property market in the first instance, if they've done all the calculations, they've done the spreadsheets, they've made sure their cash flow is good, they've cut away all the subscriptions, they've maximized their cash flow. I also say you should reduce your the amount you could borrow or use on your credit card, because of course that's taken in as a liability, even if your credit card is at zero, but you have a lending, a borrowing capacity or a spending capacity of 20 grand or that credit card, that becomes a legitimate and fair liability to the bank. Once an investor or a purchaser has decided to buy a property, what are some of the things that they consider with house versus apartment?
Well, this is quite complicated, right? Because you're right, you probably have to pay more for a house relative to a unit. You've also got, of course, all the issues relating to particularly those units constructed within the last 20 years, where we know that the quality of construction has actually been below par. You know, Opal Tower, Mascot, you know, there are lots of examples around the country. And we still don't know the full effects of the self-certification processes that were there for the last 20 years. But what we do know is that there are many places where there are cracks, where the quality of construction is below what it should be. Now, the trouble there is you could suddenly find yourself up for considerable amounts of money. So if you're in Mascot Tower, you know, you're looking at 20, 40, 60 grand, which you didn't expect to have to pay just to get your property up to scratch. That's the sort of risks that you face buying a modern apartment, plus flammable cladding, which is another thing that's also going on at the moment. Many of the modern apartments are coated with cladding that potentially is flammable, or it could be machined wood, and that's also now proved to be a flammable risk as well. So, you know, there are lots of bunch of questions you have to ask if you're going to go and think about a modern apartment. If you're thinking about an older apartment, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 years old, some of them are much more substantially built and, in fact, have less issues with noise from one apartment to the other one. That's one thing I have to think about, right? I'm particularly sensitive to noise, and I remember coming to Sydney and staying in an apartment for the first year, and I could hear the kid crying two doors down all the time. There was just no soundproofing at all. And whilst there are building standards, they're very, very limited in terms of sound insulation. So that's something else to think about. Another example is wooden floors. So if you've got wooden floors and you're, you know, people above are walking across the wooden floors, you'll hear their footsteps quite often. So there is a bunch of things to think about in terms of, you know, apartments. Now, the other point you make is the governance structure. So the strata management process. So basically when you've got a unit block being built, there'll be a builder who basically builds it, but they don't maintain it post the construction phase. They actually create a self-governing entity, the strata management company, who basically is responsible then for the ongoing management and maintenance of the common areas. People will pay into that, and frankly, one of the problems is you don't know what you're going to be asked to pay down the track. You know, in some cases, the strata fees go through the roof. You don't necessarily know how the governance processes are going to work and what decisions are taken. You know, give an example. You know, if 20 years down the track they need a new roof, you might suddenly be asked to pay extra because they don't necessarily put enough money into a sinking fund to be able to invest for future maintenance. It tends to be more hand-to-mouth. So you can be up for significant risks in terms of what you might get asked for. The other point, of course, is that you have to actually have agreement amongst the community to do things. So what happens if you've got people who just drag their chain all the time and refuse to participate? It can get really tricky. And in fact, there's quite often stories of different groups with the unions battling with each other to get stuff done. So all I'm saying to you, there's a lot of complexity about you know, the units, everything from the governance structure, the costs, the noise, construction quality, all of those things are there. Now, if you come to a house, it's worth saying that a house built in the last 20 years will be self-certified too. So, you know, it's got the same issues of quality of construction. So I always say to people, whether it's a unit or whether it's a house, it's worth getting it properly inspected by a building surveyor who is responsible for understanding and checking everything out. And by the way, that gives them some obligation to you in terms of if our issues later, so you might have recourse. Although actually, if you read the small print of most surveys, they manage to wriggle out of most of their obligations, which is another problem. But with a house, you can have construction issues, you can have construction risks. You're right also that the maintenance cost generally could be higher. It depends on the block, depends on the maintenance standards that you want. But even things like maintaining the exterior of a house, it can be quite a big job. Whereas at least if you've got a strata company maintaining units, that's part of what needs to be done. The way I think about it is there's neither a 100% good answer for one or the other. There are trade-offs between the two, and it's a bit of a combination of freedom, costs, flexibility, how much control you'll have. But I hear many more bad stories about strata management companies and people getting ripped off and people effectively not being sort of up for the task when it comes to paying more than they thought for particular elements that need to be attended to. So I think personally, I would steer away from units generally. I tend to want to be more in control, and therefore having a house is somewhat better. And by the way, my surveys show that more people these days are veering towards houses rather than units, simply because of all these issues around construction and everything else that we've touched on. So, in fact, unit prices are not going up as much as house prices at the moment.
I really feel for those people in Sydney who have that. I mean, they're one of many cases that are coming up now. Not only do they have to pay for the repairs on that massive building, but they were basically pushed out of their bedroom in their pajamas. Yep. When these cracks came, and they can't get back in there, even if it's to live there or just temporarily. You're now paying twice. You're paying for this mortgage and you're paying for somewhere to live. And if you were renting that out, you're now just paying for a loan with no return on that loan whatsoever.
And the other point, Adam, is that the value of your property just dropped.
Yeah.
Right? Because, it was $800,000. Well, nobody's going to pay $800,000 for that place today. Is it worthless? Is it worth a lot less? You don't know. And so not only have you got no access to the property, but you've also lost the capital that you put into it.
And if you're in big trouble and you need to exit, it can actually push some people in the wrong situation to the verge of bankruptcy if they can't make those payments and they can't sell.
Yep. Well, some have actually declared the only thing they can do is to declare themselves bankrupt and get out, which is horrific.
Yeah, absolutely tragic. Particularly, I'd say particularly if it's your first investment, but maybe not. Maybe you'd worked hard all your life and you've built up equity in properties and you've built up a property portfolio, and then you take a risk on an $800,000 apartment. Then it starts to crack at the foundations, and then all the work that you've done over your entire lifetime, working hard, making these sacrifices, it's all gone. I want to touch on a couple of examples that I share with you with the sound. I remember one apartment I was living in the centre of Canberra, beautiful apartment, but the sound was so bad, lying in bed, we could hear people go to the toilet in the apartment above us. And when I say Martin go to the toilet, I don't actually mean I could hear the toilet flush. I mean I could hear exactly what they were doing in that toilet whilst I was lying in bed. It was very awkward.
Yep.
The other experience I've had with, I guess, was strata. I've got a good news story and a bad news story. One bad news story was I bought a different property and everything was fine. And just after the building, warranty or certification expired, they discovered that they needed a whole new fire system. And they just put this price out to everyone saying, oh, the fire system that we put in this brand new building 12 months later, just after we've gone past the warranty period, is in fact not good enough. So can you give us $3,000? And I'm like, well, hang on a second. Now, I actually fought it and I won. But the difference between me and other people was that I had the financial backing and the legal reach and the, I guess, corporate knowledge or industry knowledge to say, no, hang on a second, X, Y, and Z. But for everyone else, they had to throw that money forward. And I thought that was really unfair that a brand new building, because fire codes are very strict, but here we had it would be different if, we had a crack in the building or a pipe broke or something, but this was a fire system installed from day one that all went wrong. The other thing I'd like to raise is parking. What they're doing now in many properties, when you buy them you look at the price and you think, oh, this is a good little property, a good little unit that I can get in there and I can live in there and get a good price. But then when you actually go to, you look at the fine print, that they'll charge you an extra X amount of dollars for a parking spot. And it's a good way, it's a good little cash cow for whoever's selling that property, because you see the advertisement, you think it's a good price, you get in there, and most people have a car, particularly if you're living in a city that you need a car, and now suddenly you don't have a car space, or you're paying an extra. In one instance, someone was a property I bought, one of them was $15,000 for one car space, and another property was $50,000 for a car space on a property that was only $300,000 to start with. So that's huge money just for a car park. However, the good side to that is if you're buying in a good location, I've also seen people do this, they buy in a good location, for example, one I've got Fitzroy, and there's a property in there, didn't need the, there's a parking lot in there, they didn't need the parking, so they actually rented the parking out and made a bit more money twice on that. But going to the instance of buying a house, when you buy a house, are there any additional expenses that would, I can think of one in particular, but from your experience, comparative to buying an apartment when you're not paying the strata fees and those maintenance, what are you paying on a house that you're not paying on an apartment?
Well, of course, you'll have your rates and the other the other things that relate to the property. Now, in some cases, you may be asked if you've got a unit to contribute to the rates, but in some cases, it's done through the body corporate. It depends on the structure there. But certainly, if you have a property, then you've got a house, I should say, then you've got rates. Remember also that there'll be a valuation, revaluation of the property and the land. And, there are all sorts of land tax related things at certain points, depending on the value of the property. Those can bite you in the bum sometimes. I think the other point, as I sort of alluded to earlier on, if you've got a house, then you've got all of the outside part to look after. And, of course, that includes the decoration and maintenance of all of the external walls and everything else. And that can be quite often quite expensive to get to. And even things like cleaning the windows, for example, that can be quite costly unless you actually do it all yourself. I think the other thing that's just worth thinking about with a house is, of course, that you potentially will be in a particular neighbourhood. It's worth checking out the neighbourhood when you think about buying, because quite often, you might find there's a really noisy person down the road. So I always say to people, if you're thinking of buying in a particular area, don't just go there during the day, during the week. Go there at the weekend. Go there in the evening and see what goes on, because in some cases you find that there's a hell of a lot of noise out of court hours, and that can be a real issue. And the other thing to check, of course, is that there isn't factories or something just around the corner, and suddenly you get a whole host of heavy vehicles going past that you weren't expecting, because that's something else. So look at the map, look and see where it is vis-a-vis commercial premises. Now, I know that you should, if you speak to a conveyancer or a lawyer, they should do some of that, but often they don't really do it very well. So it's worth looking at the map and just having a bit of a think about that as well. And then just in terms of, the property itself, I think it's worth putting some money aside pretty much every month into a maintenance sinking fund, as I call it. In other words, what you're doing is you're saving, because you're going to have to spend some stuff on it, and it's going to be lumpy. What you don't want to do is spend every last dollar you've got paying the mortgage, and then effectively, if the water system needs replacing, you've got no chance of doing that, because there's no way you can get the money to do that without borrowing on very high interest rates or on credit cards. So again, I think it's about being disciplined and it's about being structured.
Let's talk about overcapitalizing. So they first time owner or anyone moves into their first house and they get lost in these shows that talking about flipping houses, and they're like, oh, if I put in a marble floor, it's going to go up by 100,000. And then if I put in a diamond roof, it's going to go in up $1 million. Can you explain to us a bit about overcapitalizing in a property that can only reach so much value, no matter how many diamond roofs and golden marble floors you put in it?
Yeah. So essentially, think about this. What is a property worth? A property is worth what somebody else is prepared to pay for it, right? It's not the sum of all the parts of all the things that you've put into it, right? It is actually a market value. Now, sometimes people will fall in love with a property and will pay it over the odds, but actually the market generally is reasonably rational, and that means that there is a limit to what you will ever get back on a particular property, and that will be a function of where it is and how big it is and the facilities that it has and those sorts of things. But, you know, just adding gold-plated this or silver-plated that or whatever doesn't necessarily really add any true value. And I've seen so many examples where people have just over-invested in the property and they will never, ever get that totally back. Now, it might be fine if you decide to live there for the rest of your life and, you know, you love all of the, you know, the gold fittings and everything, that's fine. But if you want to sort of take a slightly more commercial view around it, then, yeah, overcapitalizing is one of the critical things to bear in mind, because there is a limit to what you can actually get back when you come to sell. And by the way, don't assume that just because it's going to auction, you're automatically going to get a higher price. That's another fallacy that we might want to touch on at some point, because quite often the only people who win at the auction is the agents, because they basically get extra fees coming from the vendor to help them cover the costs of what they're doing. So that's something else to bear in mind. So,
yeah, I remember where I live at my castle, if you will. I built a massive garage, like it's a garage bigger than my house, and it was a lifelong dream of mine. And it's got air conditioning and R7 insulation and LED lights, and it's really just a dream of mine to have this super man cave. And I remember one of my builders, he came and goes, "Mate, I think you're overcapitalizing here." And I said, "Mate, I'm not building this to sell. I'm building this because this is my castle and this is what I want, and this is where I park the cars, this is where I have my workshop, this is my baby." And he goes, "Yeah, but you're overcapitalizing." And I said, "Well, only if I'm selling. I'm going to be here probably until the day I die. This is something I want. I'm not borrowing for this. I'm paying cash for this." So I think that you raise a good point about if you choose to live there and it's your dream and you can afford to do it, then hey, no issue. We've all got desires. We've all got something we want, and we can all have the freedom, I guess, to spend the money we like. But the danger, of course, is if you're trying to do this, I've seen it a lot in these shows. You know, you see these shows on TV. The real trap I see, particularly one American show, I won't mention it by name, but they come in and they have only two or three people in front of the camera, and they say, "Look, I've just ripped up all the floor and done all of this stuff." But what they don't show is the 20 workers that are there. You know, and in America, it's a bit cheaper. Their minimum wage is much cheaper than ours. But at the end of the day, if you've still got 20 workers working 20 hours, that's big money to make that happen. And it's almost impossible to get that money back. And of course, even if you do, you're then dealing with capital gains. And it's 100% of the profit if you're doing that within the first 12 months. Martin, before we close off, is there any do not invest that you can give the people out there? What is a big red flag in the investment market at the moment?
Yeah, so let's sort of focus in on the investment side. So one of the things to bear in mind is that over the years, people will claim the way to do this is to invest in your first property, get a bit of equity in that, and then use the equity from the first into the second into the third into the fourth, right? So that multiplier effect. And in a fast growing market, people can, on paper at least, create huge amounts of potential capital, right? But remember that all that cross leverage is just a paper profit. It's not real. And unfortunately, if prices do go the other way, or if for any reason the financial structures change, like, for example, moving from interest only to principal and interest, basically that whole sandcastle falls apart. And the people who get trapped most quickly in a falling market are multiple property investors. So one of the things that I say to people is, whilst you might like this theoretical idea of having this big edifice of multiple leverage and cross leverage, et cetera, the risks are huge. And, you know, in my surveys, I survey people so regularly who can't sleep at night because they've got all of this around their necks and the property prices have gone the wrong way. So, for example, in Perth, right, prices are down in some cases 20, 30%. And they had a portfolio of investment properties. None of those investment properties are now worth what they should be. They've all got basically negative equity around each property. They're just managing at the moment to continue to pay those mortgage repayments, but they know that at the moment's notice, the whole thing could implode. That is not a good place to be. So don't be persuaded by these, big shows. And you can go and listen to people who say, this is how I made my millions, right? Leverage, 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 leverage. The risks at the moment, particularly because I don't think we're going to see massive capital gains, mean that that's a really very unfortunate thing to do. So that's the first thing. Second thing is, I think personally that when you come to investment properties, avoid cheap units, partly because of the construction issues, partly because of the fact that potentially there are many of those around. At the moment, the occupancy rates are quite low, unless you maybe look at Hobart. So you've got to be picking your property. And remember that if you are somebody who is a renter looking to rent somewhere, right, you're going to be thinking about location, access to transport, access to shops, access to other facilities as well. So when you go to think about buying, be it for own occupation or indeed for rental, it's worth thinking about that location, right? So, don't go for the cheapest one because it's away from all those facilities. The reason it's cheap is because it's away from all those facilities. That will never perform as well as somebody buying something closer in with facilities and, frankly, a more attractive property to start with. So be very careful about cheap deals, right? There's a reason they're cheap. And then I think the other thing to say is that when you think about an investment property, you should be thinking probably not just 1 year, 2 year, 3 years. You should be thinking 7 years, 10 years, 15, 20 years, because the chances are over that period of time, you may get some capital growth. You may not, but you may. There's more chance. And yet I see so many people who basically assume that they buy, investment property and it's got to have gone up. They perhaps buy off the plan, for example. And then, by the time they've moved in, they hope that the value will have gone up. Well, I can tell you that off the plan is about, on average, down 20% on average. So I wouldn't ever buy off the plan currently. Just not worth it. You're going to be trapped. And be aware of some of these developers who are offering cheap mortgages and guaranteed rental returns for 5 years. That is all to entice people into the market to shift stuff that they're trying to sell, right? But almost always, it's a bad deal. So I would avoid those as well. So I think there are some things that you can definitely avoid. The final thing to say is, if you are actually thinking about an investment property, it doesn't necessarily have to be in the same location as you're living in. So there are other locations, and I use Hobart as an example, Adelaide as an example, where there are smaller markets that are actually behaving slightly differently from the Sydney and Melbourne markets. So it is sometimes worth looking at other markets too, other than the ones that you might know more. But wherever you decide to purchase, do your research, get granular. Don't just take these high level, CoreLogic statistics for Sydney or Melbourne or whatever. Right? That's meaningless. You have to research down to the individual property in the individual road. You can get a lot of information online about sales histories and prices in the areas. It's worth researching that, because what you'll often find is that the averages that are quoted are nothing like what's really going on the ground.
You raise a good point about paying a little bit extra to get better facilities around you. Many of my tenants in many of my properties don't, in fact, have cars. And the reason why they don't have cars is because some of them are international students. Hmm. So in some instances, my little thing is I like to buy next to near universities. So I spread my portfolio all over Australia in case one property market goes down in one particular area. Now, of course, that doesn't shield me from the entire Australian property market, but if you give Perth as a good example. Maybe just from sheer luck, I missed the boom of Perth. That is, I didn't buy there before it went ballistic, but it turns out that maybe that was a good thing, because this pullback was quite painful. But buying in city centres near public transport and universities, I've actually never had any problem with tenanting out those properties. Yep. And another little method I use, if I've got a really good tenant, so in business we focus about the good provider, but I also say you should focus on the good customer. And if I get a really good customer, sometimes if they've always been good, they've always been on time, and I try to avoid any gaps in my properties. I've only really experienced it once, and that was for about 6 weeks. And again, maybe that was just luck over the years I've been doing this. I sometimes give my really good tenants 1 week for free at Christmas. I say, as a sign of goodwill, particularly as my properties are positively geared, I say, here's 1 week free for all that you've done. And that can actually help me sometimes if they're looking at a different property. That one little week free, you might say, well, Adam, why are you giving away a week free? Because that 1 week free is worth six times more than having six weeks of vacancy in that property. Ultimately, Martin, I really appreciate the time that you've given us tonight. Just one last question. Are there any banks or lenders in particular you would say look at or don't look at if people are looking to borrow money? Are you allowed to say that?
Oh, well, I'm not going to mention specific banks. Well, what I will say is that there's been a very significant spike in lenders from the non-bank sector, right? So these are entities who are getting money from hedge funds or from securitization funds, and they are very willing to lend, but almost always they'll be lending at a higher interest rate and with more fees, right? And as the major banks and regional banks and indeed credit unions have pulled back over the last 18 months to 2 years, the non-bank sector has really come in. I think, frankly, you can do better than that. My own view is that if you are actually looking for a mortgage, some of the best deals are actually available from the credit unions and building societies, the mutual sector. Two reasons. The first is they're not actually under the same profit imperative as the big guys. So they actually have a bit more latitude in terms of pricing. Secondly, because of that, they are much more focused on doing the right thing for their customers. So the customer experience and even just the cultural norms of that those organizations are better. And thirdly, they are less exposed than the big guys to things like derivatives and some of the international financing issues that could at some point hit the large end of town. So what I've tended to say to people is, unless there's a really good reason to go somewhere else, go to those smaller mutuals and talk with them first, because you'll often find you get a better deal, better experience, and an organization that really is closer to what you need compared with the big guys.
Martin North, I got a lot out of this tonight. Thank you so much. For those of you who haven't met me yet, my name is Adam Stokes. Link below. Martin, thanks for joining us tonight.
Good to talk to you. See you later.